Hey, everybody, Anna Alcoholic. Hola! Anyway, I'm like, okay, this is Mexican time. What the hell? I thought it was going to start at 7. Grateful to be here. My sobriety date is January 28, 2012. And I like to say I'm 59 years old, and I like to say my age because when I relate that to my date of sobriety, I'm only 12 years old. Mentally, emotionally, 12 years old. So it keeps me grounded, you know. Welcome to our new people. I know it's a little scary, and it seems so far-fetched to be as happy as some of the people you see in here. I actually found it attractive once I got past my little shivering, shaking phase. My home group is Mesa Group in Arroyo Grande. Near. There's my posse over there. And thank you guys. So Mesa Group in Arroyo Grande, which is near Pismo Beach. People usually can recognize Pismo Beach. And that's not my original home. I'm originally from Los Angeles and what I like to call the Mexican ghetto. Projects, it's near East LA. I grew up in the Hazard Projects, El Sereno, Lincoln Heights. If you're familiar with that area, maybe Alhambra, that's another place. I am number 8 of 9 kids, and my mom was a raging alcoholic, and I grew up in a very domestic, violent place. I like to share my part of the story because as I get a little ahead on the story, you'll realize where my gratitude comes from. I was, again, raised down in L.A. My brothers were gangbangers, and one of the things I identify with, because it's very significant to me, is when I went into sobriety, when I walked into, or I like to say when I crawled into Serenity Group of Arroyo Grande, and I sat in the back and against the wall, and I sat there shaking like a freaking little wet chihuahua, because I was scared. I was scared. You know, and I went into a room, and when I finally looked around, I seen a room full of white people. Shit, they're not gonna understand me. I'm freaking Latina, these people. And the reason I say that is because, again, you know, when I tell you the other part of my story, you'll understand. But I was raised in a Mexican, Latino freaking area. And the only white people that came in was probation officers, police officers, child welfare services, people of authority. And what I seen as a child, as a kid, was probation officers coming to drag my brothers out, or cops coming to get them, my brothers fighting the cops, my mom on jumping on top of the cops. You know, my mom never let the boys go without a fight. And that's all I knew, you know? It's important for me to remember where I come from because, again, it starts to bring into sight the miracle of this program. And so, again, so I grew up in this time where, you know, it was all, that's all it was. You know, it was the drama, it was the alcohol, it was my mom fighting physically with her boyfriends and, you know, a lot of different men and unfortunately abuse in the house, physically, mentally, sexually. It was rough, you know, and you grow up in this place where you start learning how to pretend. You know, you start learning how to not want to let anybody see what's going on. You get that look. You learn how to be that clown, you know, to be safe because you kind of know it's not okay, you know. And we moved around a lot. We never lived anywhere more than a year, and the shortest we lived anywhere was 2 weeks, you know. So my mom was a single mom with 9 kids on welfare, you know, and no hope. She had no hope. And that's what she ended up, you know, bringing on to us kids was, there's no hope. You're not going to get out of here. This is where you're going to stay. You're going to be poor. Only white people have money. We ain't going to have it. So, you know, you believe that. You know, what's pretty amazing about that is when I look at my grandkids now, which I do have 7, when I look at my little grandkids and the joy that I see in these little faces, they're so innocent, you know, and when I talk to them, I like to get down to their level. You know, I want them to see me here. I don't want them to look up at me because I remember doing that with my mom. You know, you're just this, I don't understand what's going on. And I don't ever want my grandkids to feel like that. So it's important for me to relate with them. And I was just sharing this with somebody. When I have an opportunity to visit them down in Los Angeles, which I take advantage of every opportunity, and I say my prayers in that 3.5-hour drive when I go down there, help me to be present. Help me not to steal any time from my adult kids. Help me to know how to be a better mom. And so when I'm around my grandkids, I'm able to experience that joy. And I love that when I come back and I remember, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have freaking missed it. I would have missed it, you know? So here, let me go back to, you know, what's important to me and how I had to grow up. And not having that love or that attention or that it's going to be okay. I didn't have a safe environment. I didn't know what that meant. I had no boundaries because I didn't have any space. People were all up in my business, and I thought that's the way it was, you know? I spent a lot of time with my mom being dragged into jail after jail. I spent a lot of time visiting prisons up and down California, because what's really crazy is my mom had so much pride for her boys, who were freaking hoodlums and criminals, but we were raised in a culture where the girls and the women are not looked that way. So my mom had ingrained in me, you know, a good woman keeps her house clean, her man happy, so he doesn't leave, the kids well-behaved and clean. So here, my mentality is that's what's going to make me a good woman. So, you know, I survived. We did a foster home stint, you know. My mom used to go out and drink, and only now do I understand in hindsight the importance for her alcohol. She was very sad, and she was very lonely, but I didn't understand that. She was very hateful toward me. Out of all the kids, she spent a lot of time beating me and telling me that I was a worthless piece of shit. In Spanish, it sounds a lot worse. It's so dramatic. We're so dramatic in Spanish. Escúchame, te estoy diciendo. You know, we're so dramatic. Gotta wear red lipstick. But, you know, it's verbal abuse as a little kid, and you believe it. You believe it. And so that's kind of what Anna, I also call myself Marianne, because that's what my siblings called me. So if you hear me refer to Marianne when I talk to myself, that's what started building who I was going to become, unfortunately, because that's what I was being taught. And you believe it, you know? And so, anywho, fast forward, I did end up, I was in high school, I did end up getting pregnant at 16. My high school sweetheart, we didn't know what we were doing. It just happened. And so when we told my mom and his mom, my mom's very, always negative coming out of her mouth. There was no joy. There was nothing to be said of, I'm proud of you. I'm so glad you did that. It was never like that. And so when I got pregnant, she was like, yo sabía que ibas a salir embarazada. I knew you were going to get pregnant. So here I am, 16. I get married. The husband doesn't want to go on welfare, so he's working Burger King. And we're renting a little room in the back of a house. And we're surviving, you know. We didn't get on welfare. We didn't get on cash aid. We did get WIC. You know, I kept going to school. Why did I keep going to school? Because my mom said, I knew you were going to get pregnant, you're going to drop out, you're going to move into the garage, and you're going to pay me rent, and I'm going to take care of you. She had it all lined up, and I'm like, and I was so afraid of her at this point. Here I am, 16, pregnant, get married, and I cannot drop out of school because she just told me that she knew I was going to drop out of school. So it's really interesting when you hear certain things that actually turn you into another direction. Because at that moment, I said, oh, no, she's not going to be right. And so, hence, I did Saturday school, night school, day school, and managed to get a second baby. And so I was supposed to graduate in 83, and I ended up graduating in 84. I graduated in 84 with holding my daughter on my hip in my cap and gown, with my son holding me, and my mom looking at me like, it's because of me that you graduated. And I'm like, there was no pleasing this woman. Like, literally, I felt like my shoulders dropped just like they did now, because it's like, is there anything I can do in your eyes that will let me know you love me? Like, what the heck? And in my head, I'm like, you weren't up at midnight feeding this baby who's allergic to Similac and, you know, doing your homework and crying at 16, 17. So I didn't know what I was being taught at the time. You know, I had already started with those survival skills we learn, those survival mechanisms that we learn without really realizing that we're learning it. And so Anthony and I get, you know, we're married, we have two kids, I graduate from high school, and I'm like, it was so empty in that relationship, and I only understand now that my ex-husband's like an introvert, not very affectionate, you know, but I thought being married was a lot better than being in the house with my mom, who still beat me the day before I got married. Like, she was beating me with the belt to let me know that she was still in control the day before I got married. So my mom had a lot of issues, and that's why I say that, not so that you feel sorry for me, but that you understand how sick this disease is and how it affects the family the way it does. It doesn't discriminate. It just doesn't discriminate. So anywho, I divorced from that husband because I'm like, I can't, there has to be something more. And just to reverse a little bit, I used to say that when I was a kid. I used to go in the restroom and cry after my mom beat me. Like, why does she hate me? Like, why does she hate me? A parent wouldn't do this, you know? And I just cry and I'd look in the mirror and like, God, why am I here? Like, I literally said that, God, why am I here? So fast forward, when I'm in that first marriage, I had the same questions coming up. What's my purpose? Like, is this it? You know? And so I ended up divorcing him and I became a single mom of two kids. Never worked, had a high school diploma, but I didn't want to be on welfare. I was embarrassed. Like, there has to be something more, you know? And, oh, you could just get on welfare and you'll get money. That's what they say, because that's what they do, you know? And so I ended up going into a East LA skill center and with a high school diploma and two kids. And I go through this little training program for 2 weeks, and they send me to USC on a welfare to work program. And so I am able to get to USC, and I end up doing this nine-month program. But in the meantime of that program, I was able to meet people, people who wanted to help people. And so when I got let go from that nine-month program, it was a matter of a week or two that one of those people I met said, Anna, there's a position you could be eligible for. Go apply for it. I'm like, I probably can't do it. You know, I'm not smart enough. They're like, no, you got to do it. And so I end up going, and I end up getting the job. And by this time, I met husband number two. And I love my decision makings. So I met husband number two, who was unemployed and was a drug addict. I could fix him. I will let him know how much he needs me. I'm the best thing he never had. And so I do my lovey-dovey stuff, and he's really nice. My ex-husband's cool people. I get along with my exes. I do get along with my exes because I don't believe our kids should be put through some trauma of divorce differences. So anywho, I end up meeting my husband number two, and he's in a good family. You know, he has a great mom and dad. His siblings, they're the family who taught me what it is to be in a family. I couldn't let him, like, hug me for, like, a whole year. Like, I was very uncomfortable. Like, why are you in my space? Like, my childhood experiences put that guard up. And so it took a year of them just loving up on me, that ex-husband and that family. My mother-in-law, a little four-foot shorty puff. I know she's up in heaven with some wings because that woman had a heart of gold. Very forgiving, not an alcoholic, just very loving. And so they loved me until I learned to be able to accept those hugs and to feel part of something, you know? And so here's this family that sits around the table and likes to eat and laugh and bullshit. I like that. You know, and in that process, my mom, I ended up moving in there because I had a house issue and my kids, and it was, you know, that boyfriend asked his mom, can she move in for a little bit? And she said, yeah, for the kids. And, you know, I knew him like 3 months, and they let me come in. And during that time, my mom would go over the house when I wasn't there to tell that mother-in-law of mine, before she was my mother-in-law, that you let a whore in your house, and she's a scorpion, and she's going to hurt you and your son. And I didn't know this till a few visits in, when I would see my mom drive away, when she would know I was coming home. Then my mother-in-law, she didn't hesitate. She said, I don't know why your mom's coming over here and telling me this stuff, but like I told your mom, whatever you did in your past is your business. I care about how you treat my son now. And then in my head, I even told her too, I said, your son runs this in this neighborhood, and if I was a whore in this neighborhood, he would know me. You know, he would know who I was. You know, so she's like, you don't need to explain. You know, I felt like I needed to explain. And she's like, it's okay, don't worry about it. I don't understand why your mom would do that though. And my mom kept doing it until my mother-in-law put her foot down because I didn't know how to stand up for myself. And when my mother-in-law told me when I got home, she goes, your mom came here again. And I told her, I'm not gonna have it. Don't come to my house if you're gonna talk about her. And I never had anybody stick up for me, you know? Let me reverse. One time, my brother who sexually abused me, my mom was beating the crap out of me one time because I didn't get home before the sun went down, and the sun was not all the way down. She was waiting. She was on a good one. And she beat me all the way through the house. I jumped under the bunk bed. She pulled me out by my ankles, and she wouldn't stop. And my brother, who was a regular on sexually abusing me, actually walked in and told her to leave me alone. Going through therapy and having to mention that whole idea behind my mom who beat me and my son who sexually abused me and how this one comes in to defend me, you know, kind of weird. But here, my mother-in-law, little shorty puff, really didn't know me, but put faith in me and was a good woman. I'm not going to have anybody come to my home and talk bad about somebody. You've done nothing to me. And so anywho, you know, I go through that experience of learning what it is to be part of a family. And it's pretty cool. I end up having two more kids. And when I met Frank, my Jessica and Anthony were only 2 and 3. He had no kids, but he was really super great at being a stepdad. He was just he's one of those kids just get attracted. He plays at their level. He makes them feel seen. And that's what how he was with my kids, and I admired that, you know? And so I felt we were safe, and we were, you know? And so we have that. After we had my first son together, that was my third child, I started getting introduced to some skiing substances and dry goods, as they call it. I thought, you know, the first time, because this husband introduced me to it, and I only drank because I started smoking and I would get parched. And then when we started sloping, then even more so I needed something to drink. But you know what's super funny, and I like to joke around about it with my friends, is I really thought that Coke made me social and it made me feel open to talk. And what's super funny is I talk a lot anyway. And so it was super funny that, you know, it got to a point where the ex-husband would say, Marianne, you're on rebroadcast, because I would just keep repeating myself, you know, sold to the man in the blue shoes. And it's funny because, you know, you think you need a social lubricant, and it's kind of, I've had the most fun in sobriety that I can even imagine being sober. And it's funny when we go out together and we're just laughing so hard and people are looking at us like they must be drinking, you know, without realizing how we sit there and we just bullshit over the stuff that we've done or what we're doing now or how silly we're trying to be in control of something, and we get to share that language of the heart. So I'm with that husband for 16 years. I would say 15 of those were good. I did everything for him, you know. I joke around, but it's kind of truthful to me because I know my ex-husband's wives are nothing like I was. They don't cook, they don't clean, they don't do any of that. And so I in my head, I'm like, well, they must miss me because I did everything. I did everything, you know, clothes, everything, food, get up at 5 in the morning because I didn't believe in having lunch made the day before. Like, lunch had to be done the same day, you know, and that's just what I thought it took for me to be loved, because that's what my mom said, you know, you got to be a good woman, not who I am or what can I achieve or how can I help. It was how you take care of that home. And I didn't say, I don't know who my dad is. My mom met him at a bar, and you know, the place you fall in love. So she met my dad, and remember, I'm number 8. So she met my dad in a bar, and for the longest time, I used to think he left when she was pregnant, and I never knew why, and if I tried to ask her, she would tell me to get the away, don't ask me no questions. She never wanted to tell me anything, which made it really difficult, because then I really wanted to know, why did this man leave me with this crazy lady? Like, if he knew she wasn't wrapped too tight, and that's why he left, then why did he leave me there? So therefore, another little nugget on, I don't feel loved. Like, I felt abandoned. I didn't feel safe. And that's some more of that feeling empty. You know, who can I trust? And I didn't know who my dad was. And I got to tell this because I love it because it's God's way of working in my heart. My higher power I call God. And my God today is my God that I could talk to in a casual manner. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm scared. Can you show me what it is I need to do? Show me your will. That's simple. And I always felt abandoned my entire life with my dad. And I would try to find somebody because my mom said his name was Isaac Lucero. That's where this guy comes in. I'm like, am I related to you? Are you my dad? How old are you? Because that's all I knew. His name was Isaac Lucero. And, you know, I don't hear Lucero. So that's how Anthony stood out for me on COVID. Uncle, dad. That's all I know about this man. And I end up, the husband I have now, his sister likes genealogy. And she had told me that she had found some parents of some friends. And I'm like, I'll give you my ancestry.com if you could find it. That would be a miracle. Because I tried searching over the years and I made strange phone calls. And a couple of people didn't even want to hear me when I'm like, I'm looking for my dad, you know? And it was very emotional every time because you just hoped that they would say, I might know you. I might know you, like that interest, you know? And it was always such a disappointment, and it was so painful that I just stopped doing it. And it was only in sobriety when I started really doing it. Like, God, you're my dad. You're my father. Like, you put me here. You're my dad. And I had this total spiritual experience of realizing that I have my God who brought me here, and I'm on his time. And it helped me heal through the part of my dad leaving me. So I didn't search. I made peace. I accepted. I'm cool. And then the husband's sister does the genealogy, and I'm like, well, here's my ancestry account. Knock yourself out, you know? And she ends up finding him. She finds him, but it turns out his name is Ruben Archuleta. And Sarugan Archuleta, whose mom's maiden name was Lucero. So talk about freaking fake names, right? But I'm healed at this time. I've made peace with it. God, I love you. You're my dad. You're it. You're there for me all the time to raise me up. And so I find this information about him. Like, I end up calling. I get more information on my half-siblings. And so I end up calling who would be my stepbrother, Junior, Ruben Junior Archuleta. And I call him, and I said, hey, Ancestry connected us. And he's like, well, you know, my wife is sick right now. I can't really communicate with you. What do you need? And I said, well, I just want to know where you guys live. Like, who are you? Like, I just found out your dad's name. And he says, well, I heard that I had a half-sister, but, you know, I didn't know. My dad was, you know, always out. And I said, I just want to know what kind of person he was. And this is in sobriety just a few years ago. And he says, I'll tell you this. I don't have a lot of time to talk, but I'll tell you this. When my dad was not home, it was great. My dad came home, he was an asshole, and life sucked. And I'm like, wow, okay. So I'm like, already healed, I hear this information, and it's a God shot for me. God did for me and carried me through what I couldn't do myself, because he helped me heal through the process before I found out this information. I find out this information, I'm like, wow. So I take it a step further, because this is how Marianne thinks. I didn't know who he was. He sounds like he was a real jerk because he had a family at home and he was sleeping with my mom. And then my final thought on that is like, I was a product of a really good orgasm. Like somebody that night had a freaking hell of a time because I'm here. And that's the humor that I find in what used to be so painful, because I can understand that. Somebody got theirs that night and I'm a product of that moment. So I could be okay with that and I could laugh at that because that is true to my heart. Somebody did have a good time. Or else I wouldn't be here, you know? And that's how God works through me. And I'm so grateful for that because I get to laugh at certain situations that just tore me apart. That not knowing, that not understanding, that where do I belong? You know, that feeling of being lost, you know? And so I end up, I tell the ex-husband, his family was from Tulare. And so we used to drive up to Tulare quite often. And to us, for me, getting out of Los Angeles, the hood, Tulare was freaking paradise. You guys know Tulare? Besides that, it smells like freaking fertilizer. And we stayed at a Motel 6 that the cousins later told us was on an episode of Cops, you know? But like the Hilton, you know? We were like, it was me, my ex-husband, four kids, and we had two nephews that followed us everywhere. So Anna, husband, you know, six kids. Just find a space on the floor. We're at the Motel 6. We'll go to the pool right now. And so it really amazed me one time. I walked out of the hotel. It was during the summer, or the motel, let's be honest, the Whitetail Motel. I walk out to smoke a cigarette, and I look up at the sky, and I had never seen so many stars right there in Tulare. The sky was black, sprinkled everywhere. The only stars I seen are Los Angeles. You think they're a star, and you're going to wish on it, and then you find out it's a beachy plane or a helicopter, and your star is moving. It doesn't fly, it just keeps moving, and you follow it, you know, or the line of airplanes waiting to land at LAX. So this was really amazing to me. Like, it was so pretty. And I thought, I went and I told the ex-husband, if we ever divorce, I'm moving to Tulare. And I did. When we split up, he said, you're really going to Tulare? I have a habit of self-sabotaging my relationships. I don't feel like I'm worthy in my relationships, no matter how good I try to be. And I have good ex-husbands. I had good ex-husbands. They tried to love me. They try to be there for me. And when something is so good, you just cannot trust it. I can't. I feel like something's going to go wrong. And I was filled with insecurity and fear. And I felt like I was going to be left for something better. And I would come home one day and maybe find them in bed with somebody else, like my worst fears. And I would self-sabotage, like I better leave before they leave me attitude. And you do that with kids. And mind you, I wasn't really like in my active alcoholism. Like we partied, you know, and burnt out, waste a day and a weekend, hungover, and repeat, you know. And so we got stuck in this little tide pool of alcohol and doing... Anyway, we end up getting sober, he and I, I found out I was pregnant with my Brandy. The day I found out I was pregnant with my Brandy, who's 30 right now, I didn't think I'd get pregnant. But the day I found out I was pregnant, I was actually going in for a tetanus shot because I stepped on a nail without shoes. And they told me I was pregnant, and I was like, what? And I stopped. My urges to do drugs, my urges to do smoke cigarettes, it all stopped. So I saw my brandy like a little miracle, you know, a miracle in this little child, because all of a sudden I didn't want to do any of that. It was too important for me. So the husband and I agreed not to do anything for those 9 months, and we were sober. We were good. I'm cured. We're good. And then brandy's about 6 months, and the husband's like, hey, you want to do a little? And I'm like, yeah, I guess we can handle a little, because we haven't done it. And so he brings over the, and we do it, and it starts the next few years of snowballing, of more intense and more use and more need to do more. Whoa, that was my first time experiencing doing something that had me by the ovaries. You know what I'm saying? Like, what the hell? And no matter how much we said we weren't going to, we did. Like, come that clock time, you know? And so what ended up happening in our relationships that was really good was the husband liked to do painkillers. He was one of those Mexicans, the Latinos, that I might be getting a headache, so let me take something now. I think I feel something hurting, so let me take something now. And let me have a beer to wash that down, because then it makes it feel really good. And at this time, I wasn't doing anything. So I'm like, hey, dude, I thought we were on the same page. So I started, like, detaching from the situation. And I lost respect. But I think I was preparing myself, because I was going to move. I was already thinking. And so I ended up, you know what? I ended up cheating on him with somebody we knew. And I wanted myself to be openly admitting that I'm a dirty person. You see what decision I made? I'm not a good person. You don't deserve to be with me. Do you know he still wanted to be with me after that episode? No matter how much it embarrassed him, because the whole freaking neighborhood knew. And I always was one that throw my soul on the table. Like, I felt I needed to confess to my mother-in-law what I did. Like, I wanted everybody to despise me for the ugly person that I was. I set up my own situation. And so I end up moving out, but we end up getting back together. Like, he really wants to stay with me. I know we could work through this. And I'm like, okay, we'll try. But then I couldn't. That guilt, that shame, that you don't deserve this. So that's when I said, I'm moving to Tulare, you know? And we decided the kids were older except my brandy. So we decided to share brandy. He kept her, and I went to Tulare and set up shop. Now, what I am fortunate to do is, which I don't know if any of you guys may identify, is I could get a job. One boss told me, you have the power of gab, Anna, and I didn't even understand what that was. But I like working with people, and I do like to talk to people, and I do like to meet people. And so I did go to Tulare, and I ended up getting a job via computer. And I met them the day that I went into the job. They offered it to me. And I worked there temporarily. I worked there for about 6 months before I ended up with the County of Tulare. So anyway, fast forward, I shared custody of Brandy, and I started drinking a little bit more at that time because the cousins love to drink. And these are the ex-husband's cousins. I had no family. And his family liked to drink. That's what they were known for. That's how we got to Tulare. We were always going to funerals. People dying of cirrhosis, of alcoholism. That's how I got to know Tulare. I'm like, Dan, is that all your family does? And then they'd sit there and argue drinking on whose family was more alcoholic than the other. That was crazy, because my mother and father-in-law, tu hermana está más borracha que, you know, and yours, you know, whose alcoholic is worse than the other. I would sit there like, you guys are crazy, because I wasn't into alcoholism, or I wasn't yet a full-blown alcoholic at that time, so what did I know? So so we divorced, and I'm at Tulare, and I end up meeting husband number three, who is 17 years younger than me, two weeks younger than my oldest. My Anthony's 42, my Jessica's 41, my Frankie's 37, and my Brandy's 30. So husband number three was, I called him an old soul. Sometimes I had to tell him to act his age. But he was raised old school with his mom. But he had issues because he was in a very, he grew up in a very abusive home with his stepdad beating him all the time and his mom not defending him. So I could fix him, right? Get into a relationship and let me fix this person. I want to feel useful. I want to have purpose. You know, so RJ and I end up moving in together, and he's trying to take care of me. He ends up re-enlisting in the service. He does. He ends up going into he goes to Iraq twice in the time that we're together. But that time apart wasn't even, you're strangers, you know? How do you do this thing in a relationship? How do you be part of something and not all of it, you know? And so we end up parting ways, which he was pretty sad about it, but you know, I realized it was not right. And so in comes ex-husband number four. Are you keeping up with me? ex-husband number four is only 15 years younger than me. Let me reverse a little bit. RJ was one of those people I met at the bar who lit my cigarette and filled my wine glass and opened up the door and carried the groceries. I like you. You meet my standards. You know, we're good. Let's get married. And then number four liked to drink, play guitar, and sing Elvis. Let's get married. You know? And so number four is the one who I used to give credit for the first few years, and then I said, fuck that dude. He introduced me to the Central Coast. I didn't know anything about the Central Coast. Never been here, didn't know about it. And I have always been admired by the beach. The ocean to me is that reminder that there is a God. And the second reminder is a woman. A woman's body that can hold a baby inside. Our body, whether you have children or not, our body is made in a way that God has made us to be able to reproduce and to do that. So to me, the biggest miracles is a woman and the ocean. So massive. How do you explain that? So that's what carries me through. So here, X number four takes me over to the Central Coast, and I'm like, this place is freaking beautiful. You know, and then he introduces me to Mr. Ricks, and of course we need to go to the drinking holes, because now I'm with somebody who drinks like I do and smokes like I do, cigarette. You know, so it doesn't matter if you kiss them, because you taste the same. So Jared, you know, tall white dude, just goofy, silly, plays guitar, sings Elvis, right on, great voice. A few visits here, I'm like, I'm moving to the Central Coast. And so he's like, well, I'm going with you. And so I go to my boss at Tulare County, great job. I was there 10 years, secure, 10 years there. And I go in and I had her hand her my letter of resignation, and I swear, she tells me, where are you going? I said, I'm moving to the Central Coast. And she's like, where are you gonna work? So I don't know, I'll find something. Because I always had that, I could get a job somewhere, you know? And she's like, God, I wish I could live like that. And in my head, I'm like, well, stop supporting your sons. You know, you could retire. But she did everything for her sons, everything. So I submit that resignation, and then you know what I do? I do what any good alcoholic would do. I cashed out my retirement. Woohoo! So, and because I'm a good woman, I pay up to date the dude's child support and his bills to get them all caught up so we can come to the Central Coast nice and fresh, clean start. And, you know, it's crazy, it's chaos, and my drinking shoots and it goes off. And what's really amazing, people, is that I moved to the Central Coast to start a new life, and that my life would be beautiful if I was anywhere near the water, which there I was, without realizing that I would go into a location where my God will tear me down to the floor so that he could start to rebuild me. And that's the freaking miracle. It gives me chills still thinking about that, because I do live near the beach, and my life is great, and it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I continue to gain here. Doing, you know, this program with a sponsor and having a fellowship of people that you start to learn to trust. And a fellowship that is by far more than I could have ever imagined. You know, people who normally would not mix. That is like freaking right on for me. People who would regularly not mix, all of a sudden could sit there and understand what the other person is saying, sharing their pain or their accomplishments. Or, dude, you freaking got a month. You got 4 months. Woo, woo. Even though you don't realize it, we know, because where you're at is where we were, and where we are is where you can be. You know, there's hope here, and it doesn't feel like that when you're new, because it's, you don't understand. Like, how can something like that really be real? And then, how do I deserve something like that? Like, I'm not worthy, you know? So there's this whole psychic change that starts happening slowly by slowly. So Jared and I end up in a very domestic relationship, and it was not him hitting me. It was me going off on him. So he's about 6'4", and I just found out I'm 5'2". I thought I was 5'4". Whatever. And so my daughter's like, Mom, I always knew you were shorter than me. I'm like, just let me be. So he's 6'4", I'm 5'2". And here's what happened. I never wanted to be like my mom. My mom, like I said earlier, used to have brutal fights with their men. And it's like she had this power thing, and she was brutal. She freaking poked a hole with a high heel and one dude. So I turned into this banshee. Because I'm drinking with this guy that drinks like me. We get along, he sings great, and yada, yada, yada. All of a sudden, I start seeing red. I don't know why. I went in with the good intentions of getting along, and let's have a sing-along, and, you know, watch the sunset, and all that bullshit, and I turned into a banshee. You know, I started chasing him with knives. I'm not gonna admit anything else. I know it's being recorded. But I started chasing him, and I turned into this violent little freaking little chihuahua, you know? And I'd wake up in the morning, and he'd have a bite mark on his cheek, and I'm like, what happened to you? He's like, you don't remember? You bit me. And I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, why are you lying? And then I'm looking at him like, how did I get up there? And then I'm looking at him like, you shouldn't have been near me. Because how did I get your cheekbone? You know, you're, what were you doing? And anyway, I turned into this violent person, and broke my elbow one time chasing him. In the morning, I woke up like, oh, my arm. And he's like, you don't remember what happened? And I'm like, as usual, no. What are you talking about? And he said, you were running around outside chasing me with a knife at 5 o'clock in the evening in this huge apartment complex in your underwear. And I'm like, what? And any alcoholic. I look down to see what underwear I'm wearing because I want to know if they're cute, you know? And I'm like, shit. And then the second thought kicked in, like, everybody comes home from work at that time. What was I doing chasing him with a knife? And he would mock me when I would do things like that because he knew he could outrun me. And I had to go and get a pin in there because it was broken, and which I still have the scar, which reminds me. I also have a scar right here from drinking at him when I crushed my wine glass. Oh, yeah. And I freaking severed it. I can't feel my thumb. Stupid things we do. Drink at people. So anywho, Jared and I lived together for a couple years, and he ends up saying, I need to leave. And I'm like, okay, go. Because at this point, I wanted to drink the way that I wanted to drink. I had tried a little two-day stint in the cottages, and I didn't last because I knew he was homeschooling somebody. I just knew it. I need to get back home. Of course he wasn't. He was drinking and smoking and whatever. But my head always tells me that I'm not good enough. So anywho, he and I end up splitting up. He leaves, and I proceed to drink myself, hoping that God will just kill me. You know, because at this point, I don't really understand the alcohol problem, but at this point, I'm just kind of looking at it like, I don't know what's going on. I'm crazy. I should have control over this. Like, what the heck's happening? You know, and I didn't understand it. And alcohol, you could not convince me that alcohol was my problem, because up to that point, she was my BFF. She gave me the ovaries to say what I wanted to say, do what I wanted to do, everything that I thought I should act on, because I'm an adult now, and I could do that and act the way I want to, and it fed that. It fed that ego. It made me feel a little lifted. And so anywho, I end up doing that two-day stint, and I go back home, and when I get home, he's like, I'm leaving. I'm like, great, go. And so I got a DUI. I got my only DUI just before he left. I went for a last run. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I'm like, I don't have enough inventory, that little cigarettes, alcohol, 11, because I was doing that little clock game, the clock game where if I drink by 10, I'll stop at that time, and then I can go to work tomorrow feeling okay. And there was none of that anymore. And I ended up going to a last run for alcohol, but I also had started taking Ambien recently. And so the alcohol affected me a little quick. So I was coming home, and I was about to turn into my driveway, and I sideswiped 3 cars. And my airbag goes off, and I'm like, whoa, and this is at 11 o'clock at night in that apartment complex where everybody's looking to see what the hell happened out there at 11 o'clock at night, you know? Everybody and their grandmother comes out, and the cops come, and all I can remember is just crowds talking right around me, and they're trying to do this, and I'm just, put me in the car. Just put me in the car, you know? And so they take me, and they arrest me, and yada, yada, yada. I get out. They're saying you got to do community service, you know, and I don't do the community service because I don't got time. I work and I got to go home and drink. I ain't got no time for community service. So here, 7 months after my DUI, I'm drinking myself as much as I can, you know, morning, noon, and night. Weekends, I don't know if it's day, I don't know if it's night, you know. You hear if the kids playing or the roosters crowing. They do a warrant sweep. Because I didn't even know I had a warrant at this time. So 7 months after the DUI, the cops come, you know, can we come in? I'm like, okay, I let them in. I just got laid off of a job on Friday. Saturday, I buy all this alcohol so that I could drink myself to death. And they come and get me on Sunday. And I'm about to pour myself breakfast, which I got to make a correction. I've always said I'm pouring breakfast, but when I got my mug shot and it said what time I got picked up, it was actually 1 in the afternoon, which kind of coincides with that losing track of time. So anywho, they pick me up, 4 cops, and I'm just insulted at the fact that your taxpayer's money and it takes 4 of you to come get me, you know, and I'm like, And my mugshot shows that look, too. So they take me, and I got to do what I call 3 hard days in the pinta. I want to get a little tattoo right here. I did 3 hard days, and you know what's really crazy is I was in a dorm with 60 women, and I didn't know that I was dry heaving. I didn't know what was happening to me because I hadn't had alcohol. They were hovering over me, here, just drink some water, here's some bread. And I'm like, what are they doing? Like, they knew what I didn't know. And so I do the 3 hard days. I go home and I proceed to drink myself. This is it. I'm going down. You know, I will kill myself. I got tired of calling the kids and telling them I was going to kill myself. The kids got tired of hearing me say that, so they started blocking me. And for anybody who thinks you can't tell if you're drunk by a text, yes, you can. Because you slur when you text. And so the kids blocked me, you know. That's what they had to do. And so so I get home, and I start drinking, and I'm just smoking. I'm not eating. I'm not drinking water. And here I have my moment of clarity after a few days of doing that. I can't swallow, so I go over to the kitchen sink to get a little glass of water. And I put the glass up, and it shakes so bad I can't put it to my lips. And that was my moment right there. Something's wrong. And I just said, God, I can't do this anymore. Please help me. Those were the words that fell out of my mouth, and it sounds so cliche because so many people say that, but that's what it takes to get where you got to get when you got to get there. You know, it doesn't happen any sooner. I'm a firm believer of that. I didn't get here one day sooner than I was supposed to. You know what I'm saying? So that if you're regretting, like, I could have had more years, I could have had more, you know, God put you here right when you needed to get here and learn what you need to learn while you're here, and it's a journey. And so so I give my surrender prayer, and then all I could do is call that ex that I try to, that I chased with a knife a few times. And he said, I can't do this no more. And he said, I'll be there right now. I'll bring you some food. And he brought me food, and I took a hot shower, and we sat on the floor, and I ate. And he just chit-chatted with me. And the next day, that's when I went into Serenity in Arroyo Grande, not knowing what it was going to give me. You know, I didn't know what they were doing. I seen these steps on the wall. I'm like, okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, okay, I guess. I never knew what sanity was, but I guess. And then I see step 4, and I'm like, make an inventory. I thought we're starting new. Why are we bringing up old shit? Like, I don't want to come in here and remember what I did. You know? I don't get 4. And tell somebody? I don't think so. What's the shortcoming? So, you know, I learned 6 and 7. To me, has felt like the meat and potatoes of the program, kind of. I kind of think it gets a little breezed over sometimes, but it truly is meat and potatoes. Then you get into this 8, you know, where you make the list, and which is kind of a carryover from 4. But, and then 9, the opportunity to make that amends. I went down to Los Angeles when I had a year and 2 months sober. No, February. It was a year and a month sober. And I told my youngest daughter, she's my road dog. I said, Brandy, I'm going to come down, and I'm going to make my amends, Mom. And this is what I need you to do. I need you, when I'm going to go to Anthony, I'm going to let you know so you could take Jessica and Frankie that way so I can have alone time. So we had a game plan. So I go to my son and I make an amends. I'm sorry. Thank you for sponsorship, who said, cut down that freaking apology. You don't need to freaking over-explain your, I know I did this to you. I wasn't there for you emotionally. You know, I'm what I could do now, what can I do? You know, making that genuine amends. And my son's like, I'm just glad you're sober. And then I tell Brandy, okay, victim number 2. I go over to my daughter, I do the same thing. Just glad you're sober. Frankie. And it turns out, I do my amends with the kids in the parking lot of Petrillo's. If you've ever been to San Gabriel, Petrillo's pizza is the bomb. So we said, we're going to meet at Petrillo's. So we're in the parking lot. I'm able to do these amends, and we go into Petrillo's. And my daughter-in-law, who's fucking a gem, married to my son Frankie, her mom's in the program. And her mom told them, you don't know how important it is to get 1 year in sobriety. What your mom has accomplished is a big deal. So my kids didn't know, they didn't understand. So I walk in this restaurant and there's balloons and there's a cake. And I'm like, what the heck? And here, this is for you, Mom. And they had gifts. And my daughter-in-law's mom just smiling at me. And I'm like, this is amazing. They might not understand it, but they know their mom's sober and they know she's doing something different. And we're going to celebrate her. And so that was my amends with my kids. And what I've learned in this time, that amends will always continue, because like with sobriety, that's always evolving. You know, the onion, I know the peeling of the onion sounds a little corny, but what other way is there to say it, you know, other than, I'm going to take off another sarape? I don't know, what am I going to say, Pancho? You know, it's an onion. You know, it's a freaking onion. But it describes that whole process of I get to another part of my sobriety and, wow, there's a situation going on in my life or something that ends up like teaching me something. And that's what's super cool about this program. When I ended up coming in, and they're like, you need to get a sponsor. And I'm like, I don't like to ask for help. That's not how I was raised. You do it yourself, and you don't tell people your shit. So that's why when I looked at the steps, I'm like, that's not how I was taught. So here I'm going to have to go against what I grew up believing, you know? And so what's super cool is, again, God does for me what I can't do for myself. Some woman comes up to me and says, I'll sponsor you. I'm like, okay. You know? And at that time, Serenity used to have a breakfast once a month at a little area in Grover Beach. And so we go to this breakfast. You get breakfast, and then they have a speaker. So this woman, her name's Pamela, are you serious about this program? And I'm like, yeah. Because at this point, I had like 3 months sobriety, 4 months sobriety. And I was taken. Like, that was my moment of, I couldn't get 24 hours. I couldn't get a freaking hour at the end of my drinking. That all of a sudden God gave me 24 hours. Oh my God, I have 48 hours. What do I got to do? So here I'm unemployed. I get a bus pass since I hadn't had since I was freaking 18. I don't have a car because remember I had that DUI and I was too busy to put gas in it and I let them tow it away and I never went for it. I got to drink, you know? And so I'm on the bus. I'm sober. I'm about to have to leave my apartment. But all I could think about is I need to get my ass to that room. And so I would go to Serenity. I'd catch the first bus out at 5:30 in the morning to get to Serenity at 6:45 a.m. I would stay at Serenity or get back on the bus and cruise around until their 12 noon meeting. And then after the 12 noon meeting, I started volunteering to stay in the Alano Club. I did not want to go home. It was necessary for me at that time not to, because there's a particular routine that was connected to my drinking. I needed to change the pattern. And so I felt safe in AA. So I'd get back on the bus, go cruise around, and then I started getting off at the library. I read more books in my first 3 months of sobriety than I have in my entire life. I kid you not. Then the color started getting brighter. I'm sitting there waiting for the bus, and I'm looking at the flowers. All of a sudden, everything looks bright and beautiful. If I had a car, I would have missed it. I didn't have a car. I had a bus pass. Therefore, I had to. But here's the deal, too. People would offer me, Anna, we'll give you a ride home. But no, it's okay. I'm fine. In the winter, we'll give you a ride home. No, I'm fine. I am. And I'm shaking. I'll come. You know, get home, take a hot shower, melt it all down. Because I didn't know how to say yes. I still had that little piece of me that if you do something nice for somebody, you're going to have strings attached. Then you're going to owe them. I don't want to owe anybody. And so AA has taught me how to put down that guard. You know, I end up working with this sponsor, and we do 1, 2, and 3, of course. What's funny is when we were at the breakfast, when she said, are you willing to go to any lengths, that tricky question, and I said, yes. She said, then let's get down on our knees right now and do the third step prayer. The room was like this. Now? On our knees? She's like, are you willing? At that point, I was like, take me, baby Jesus, let's get on our knees. I didn't know the prayer. She's holding my hands. Nobody said anything. Nobody, whatever. They just kept mingling like it was nothing. And that's when I really dove into it, because I realized I was willing to do anything. I'll get on my knees in front of a bunch of people I don't know. What the fuck? You know, it's not like I was hiding my drinking outside and rolling down my own stairs at my apartment that people had to go throw me back in my apartment. What am I going to hide from? That's where my willingness came in to do the steps and to be honest about it, as honest as I could be. And again, thank you to sponsorship, who guides you to that. Stay in the columns. Stay in the columns. This is what you need to include. And the biggest, like, what? Put your name at the top of the list. That gives me chills. Put my name on the top of the list. You've hurt yourself. You've wronged yourself. You go on that list too. I was like, I didn't get it. You know, okay, I'll do it. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I have administrative support background. I still do. I do an Excel spreadsheet. You know, Excel spreadsheet. Columns. Colors. Itemized. What you did to me. You know, and I pull up, we go across the street from Serenity, nice little park, pull out my Excel spreadsheet, and she comes out with a pinchy red pen. No, you're not going to mess up my spreadsheet. Starts crossing out stuff. No, not that. No, not this. What was your part in here? What do you mean my part? I don't have a part. What expectations did you have about that particular da-da-da-da-da? Start writing notes on there. And so she broke it down for me in a way that I could understand it. I don't know if any of you guys could identify with this feeling, but this is what happened with me. We got done working the step. And we end up walking back across the street to attend a meeting at Serenity at noon. And I don't even feel like I walked. I felt like I levitated. Because what happened in that experience of doing step 4 and 5 was I was able to unload trash bags. It felt like trash bags of trash that belonged to other people, not me. I volunteered to carry their load that was not mine to carry. And what's really crazy about that is I always joke around when I say, there I felt like I needed to carry the torch that nobody really handed me. Nobody handed me a torch and said, here you go, Anna, don't fuck it up. Nobody did that. I brought that upon myself based on the way that I was raised and my beliefs and my lack of core value. And so anyway, I felt like I levitated back to serenity, and it took me to a whole new spiritual level, you know? And we worked 6 and 7, and then she had to move away. So there I had to find another sponsor to work the other steps with me. And she was a great sponsor, Christine. Super nice. I still see her. And she took me through the other steps, which, again, sponsorship. We don't do this alone. You just don't do it alone, or else you're kind of being guided by a blind person, you know, to work the try to do this on your own. It just doesn't happen. I like when they used to tell me, when you're home alone with a crazy person. You need to get the hell out. You know, don't stay home alone. You'll get stuck in your thinking. And so Christine walked me through the other process, which, again, when she helped me get focused on step 9 so I could be prepared for my kids, she helped me realize that I didn't need to list all the things I thought were my sins, that I'm doing the amends for the sake of my children, not the relief that I could get, what I could do for you. And I didn't understand that. So that's what I learned about that process of doing step, 8, 9, and 10, 11, 12. You know, that's, I know I hear people say, I live in step 10, 11, 12. They don't go to meetings. I just heard somebody tell me the other day, well, I don't really need to go to meetings because I live in step 10, 11, and 12. And I'm like, I get like, my heart sinks because I would not want to see anybody have to go out and drink. But I also learned in this program that we all don't stay. We all don't stay. My first friend who died from alcoholism, she was a psychologist. She was beautiful. She was smart. And she was living at a women's home because she had an alcohol problem. And so when I'm at Serenity, this is, I love this. I go back and forth if you guys are riding my roller coaster with me. At Serenity, what it taught me was there was, Alano Club had a kitchen. And there was a woman on Wednesday making tacos, rice, and beans. And I'm like, she was white. And it was Rosarita beans. And it was rice-a-roni Mexican style rice. Rice-a-roni Spanish style rice. And I'm like, and so I tell one of my elders, whom I love my elders because they taught me and they called me out on shit. I tell him, I said, I could really like, I cook, you know? And he said, Anna, if you could get her out of the kitchen, good luck. Knock yourself out. Because some people take a responsibility and they won't let it go. So much for spiritual rotation. And so I sneak myself in there and, can I help you, Virginia? And she's like, well, okay. And then a couple of times, she really didn't want to do it anymore, but she didn't know how to say it. So when she seen my interest, she's like, I can give you this responsibility. So Wednesday became my taco day. And so here's the deal. Remember that family I told you about down in LA, my ex-husband, they taught me how to be united. When I got divorced, I lost all of it. I lost all that connection. I was so alone when I moved up to Tulare. So here I'm in the Alano Club, authentic, and I'm cooking Mexican food. I go to the six, I get there at 6 o'clock, 6:45 for that meeting. As soon as the meeting's over, I go and I boil my beans and I start my fresh salsa. And then I make my Mexican rice and then I prep everything for the tacos. Like, I'm authentic. And people are like, it smells like fresh beans in here, you know, because that's how I cook. I started feeling part of. People were excited to come and eat. And I love, my friend back there says, Anna, your love language is making food and my love language is eating it. That's my back there. But food has always been a language because it doesn't charge. Like Thanksgiving is all about food and gathering together and being grateful for something. Christmas, unfortunately, has turned into something bigger. And kids nowadays are a lot different than back in the days. You can't just give them a Barbie, you know? It's not gonna work. So here I'm part of a place that makes me feel I feel part of. And then the language of the heart. And the relation and the identifying and the feeling connected, like, whoa, this is cray-cray. And I'm so jazzed and I'm so stoked about sobriety. I'm stoked about what I'm learning. Now, just to let you go back to the beginning, when I had to work the steps and somebody said the importance of working the steps, I said, if you guys can convince me that my mom loved me, I'll do whatever you tell me. So that was early in sobriety. I put that out there. If you could prove to me my mom loved me, I'll do whatever you tell me. So there you go. When I think of that in hindsight, I think, you know, I didn't know. I'm a movie buff and a music buff. I will quote movies like, I felt like The Matrix. Do you take the red pill or the blue pill? You know, I just identify with certain things like that because that was part of my upbringing, music and movies. And so they just keep coming back, work the steps, you know, just keep coming. And so we're going through this and I'm making amends and I'm learning to heal and recover, make peace with my past, because that's very important, is to make peace with my past, because then I won't keep bringing it into the now. And I like when I was taught that. If I have one leg in the past and one in the future, I'm pissing on today. And I'm a firm believer of that because I was a pro at past tripping and future tripping. I could never be in the present because don't you know what happened? It's going to happen again. And I couldn't live in today. I was always in a panic, and I was on a need to know. I need to know. And AA taught me you're on a need to know basis because God will let you know when you need to know. And so I had to learn that, and that patience and that the willingness to just sit still. Like, I didn't know how to do that. Sit still? Like, how do you do that? So anywho, I'm trying to watch time because this could turn into a slumber party. So AA's, I get to that first year of sobriety, and I am so excited. And what I learned in that time that is not everybody is excited for you when you get sober. You'd be surprised a couple of people who are love to have you be in your drinks, you know, because you're not your best version. And so I had somebody, you don't do it, but I started dating early in sobriety. And I'm super grateful that he was an introvert and really not connected to people because that helped. Otherwise, I would have clung to him like freaking white on rice. But when I got that year, he's like, oh, now you think you're all that because you got a year. And, you know, that's where that stuff kind of started with you realize that not everybody's happy. And what I needed to start learning was that I need to be reminded by myself that I have a choice of what people I surround myself with. You know, that's really important. And that I'm in a room full of alcoholics, too. So for me to expect perfection or that everybody's going to be working the program the way the book tells us to, doesn't happen. What I also learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it doesn't matter how much time you have. It's quality. I think of quality, not quantity, when it comes to sobriety. And I'm surrounded by people who have quality sobriety. And what I also learned is I have seen people of 30 years, and it was those expectations. I remember my first, sponsors actually, had a lot of time of sobriety, but the way she lived and the things she did and the choices she made or the way she talked about people, I didn't feel comfortable with that. And that's when I realized, you know, it's quality. People see how you walk. People see how you talk. People are watching. So I always had that, I want to be a good message, God. Help me be a good example of what the program offers and what you offer me. And so so that friend of mine, I was about 5-6 months sober, and Marie, I don't know if you guys remember Marie, she came, Anna, can I help you wash dishes? And I'm talking a very fancy woman who's been taken by alcohol, and she struggled with relapsing. And I had got home one day, and my roommate came out. He's like, hey, have you talked to so-and-so? And I said, no. He says, well, I just want to let you know that they found Marie dead. And my knees buckled, and I almost fell to the floor, and my roommate caught me, and I cried so hard because that was my first experience seeing we don't all make it. We will die, you know? And Marie couldn't get it, no matter how smart she was. You know, sometimes they say people could be too smart for the program. And people want to figure this out on their own and not realize that they need to rely on the program and the fellowship to help them get through this. And so she was my first experience. And then I had another friend who had a stroke, was in sobriety. She had years of sobriety, but because she had a stroke, it affected her quality of life, and she couldn't handle it. So her husband went out on a little store run, comes home, and she took all her sleeping meds. She killed herself. She killed herself because she didn't feel she had a quality of life because of that stroke, and she was so beautiful. And she was so sweet and so honest, and she was one of the first gringas, the white woman, who say, Anna, I really hate how happy you are, but I love your sobriety. Because I would always be happy, and it doesn't rub people the right way. Like, it offends people sometimes to be happy. How can I not be happy? I came into a program of people I didn't even freaking know with this vision of what I can't trust you, to a whole surrender and acceptance of trust in the process. And I come in this room where I have a speck of hope, not even knowing what hope is, and a circle of darkness, and then that gets turned around to where I have this freaking huge thing that I have this much darkness. And it's something that my friend over there always says, it's not something you could really explain. You got to experience it. When you experience it, then you start realizing that, man, there's something greater out there than me. Whether you call it God, whoever you call it, throw it up to the universe, whoever your higher power is, that's what you start putting your trust. And I'm a firm believer of it's one thing to believe in God, but it's another to rely on him. And that's two different things. I believe in God, but do you rely on him? Because that is something that you do. And what was significant to me in early sobriety is like, you guys are telling me I need to trust in something I can't see, smell, or touch. I need to trust something that I can't see, smell, or touch. How do you do that? It's like walking through a dark room, you know? Then this reliance and this trust, I'm able to connect it with, well, when I go on a roller coaster, I'm hoping the mechanics didn't go with the cheapest bid, put in those nuts and bolts, and that roller coaster is going to stay on the rail when it takes that big dip. Do we not trust those people? We don't even know them. You put on your seatbelt and you're just cackling like a little kid. Or how about this? This really gets me. How the hell do airplanes stay up there? As big as they are. But you're trusting that whoever put that stuff together put the right amount of fuel in to get you where you're going to go. So why not this higher power? Why not this God? You know? So I'm a firm believer. Like I said, I had enough miracles in my little 12 and a half years to know that there has been a psychic change, a big change in my life, because I came in, I even told somebody early and said, I wish I could just take my brain out, put it in a wash cycle with a little bit of Suavitel or Downy, make it nice and fluffy, anti-static, and then give me my brain back, nice and clean. How else do you forget what you've done or what's been done to you? How do you forget that shit? Oh, make peace. No, the memory brings it back like it just happened yesterday. That's how powerful memories are. I could hear a song that'll take me back to my childhood. I could see a movie that takes me back there. And like I said, I'm a big movie person. My life, because it was so crazy, I watched movies to see that's the Brady Bunch. You know, freaking Father Knows Best. That's what families are like. I gotta be like that. Or songs. AA ruins love songs. Get no Al-Anon? That I can't live if living is without you. I will survive. You know, those songs you drank to, you know, I could get over him. I could survive, you know, I will survive without you. And then you come back, I forgot to take that key from you. You know, it took me a long time to forgive Rose for letting go of Jack. Rose said she'd never let go of Jack, and the bitch let him go. And I swear, it was just recently that I understand the metaphor behind letting go in order to live. So now I forgive Rose, because I understand what's behind the story. He wanted her to live, and that's how I believe my God works in my life. You didn't successfully kill yourself, drink yourself to death, because I had a reason for you to be here. So backtrack to my young days when I'm like, what's my purpose, God? Why am I here? Why do I keep getting beat up? I don't understand, you know? And here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I'm taught the importance of fellowship, the importance of being honest, and the importance of service, you know? Elizabeth, you shared this last night. I just became GSR for my area 5 months ago. And I'm one of those people that I want to know more. Like, shit, this works? Like, when they told me I had a job that was very hard to be at because it was a private office, which I never do. I have bigger capacity, USC, Cuesta College, Tulare County, and here let me try a little medical office. Doctor and his wife, who proudly say, we're perfectionists. We're perfectionists, Anna. And I'm feeling self-doubt, and I can't do my job because these people, I'm not reaching their expectations. My sponsor tells me, Anna, anybody who claims to want to be perfectionists are trying to be better than God. I heard what I needed to hear at the time I needed to hear it. Thank you. I'm going to stop second-guessing myself. And I'm in this program that continues to teach me how to do that and to start recognizing who I am, you know? And slowly by slowly, because I grasp this program and I want to keep doing it because that job I didn't like, I remember stopping at a stop sign before I was going to get into the office, literally looking at my windshield, God, please. Please help me get through this day and help me to be of maximum service. Help me not to be sidetracked by this doctor and his wife that want to tell me I'm not doing what I need to be doing their way. Please, God, focus. So I go through my whole day, and it wasn't until I got home at night that I'm like, oh my God, I had such a great day. I didn't worry about this. Holy shit, this works. Like out loud to myself, like this works. That prayer thing, when I'm wholeheartedly, genuinely asking God and trusting that I'm asking him for something I'm willing to do, then something happens. You know what I'm saying? And it's that power in the prayer and the intense sincerity, genuine prayer of asking for guidance because I don't know. That freedom early in sobriety of learning that I don't need to know everything. I don't have to have the right answer. It's okay to say, pues yo no sé, let's find out together. I didn't know that was okay. And so that's part of the stuff that I still get to learn. And it was people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I work at Cuesta. I only had a high school diploma. I get this crazy thought that, you know what, maybe I should go for an associate's degree, you know, lift myself up. And I went in with a lot of self-doubt. I'm not smart enough. I'm too old, yada, yada, yada. Then I have friends in the program who share their experiences, whether it was dyslexia or whatever, you know, and share how they got through it. And a lot of prayer. God, please don't let me quit, because that's my prayer. Don't let me quit. help me to follow through what I just started. And then if it doesn't, it's something different, it's something different. And that's how I rely on that kind of guidance, deep to my core. I need to be shown how to do it. You know, I need to be shown how to be a good employee. I want to be. That's just it. I want to know what it's, you know, I want to know what it's like to be in a relationship. You know, will I ever be in a relationship where I don't have to worry about them screwing somebody else? Will I be in a relationship where I feel that I'm loved and that I could love back? You know, that trust, you know, how do you do that? And I remember having a prayer with my God and saying, God, you're my eHarmony.com, because I'm not paying no more money for freaking membership. Because they're all about, like, they should just be honest and say, I'm looking for a one-night stand, you know? Why do all this other, you know, stuff? And that's not what I was looking for, but it was that surrender of what I have no power over. I don't. My picker's bad. I don't know how to do a relationship. My idea of a relationship was watching my mom be in fear. And so anywho, I just want to fast forward because there's been some episodes in my life that have been very significant in sobriety. And one was just a few years ago. I had a moment in my car. I always talk to my God throughout the day. I just do. I had a moment in my car because I'm trying to develop this relationship with my daughter that I had when I was 17. We're not connected like me and my Brandy. I pray and I pray hard. God, help me to connect with my Jessica. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what's blocking us. So my prayer is, show me in a way that I can understand. So I'm always doing that, so I got to be ready. So I'm sitting at a stop sign, and I'm like, have this thought, like, oh my God, my mom was an alcoholic, because my mom and I never had a relationship, and here I'm praying for me and my Jessica, but God turns me around and says, and I'm like, my mom was an alcoholic. Oh my God, she was so scared. She didn't have AA. Like, I literally was doing this. And it was the most emotional thing for me, because at that moment, from one alcoholic to another, it was a moment for me to understand my mom was so alone. She was alone and so unhappy and so full of fear, you know? And as an alcoholic, I could understand that. Now, I like to say my mom and I have the best relationship ever. We do. She died in 2006. I got sober in 2012. So if you think that you cannot heal over something that you think is a lost, it's not gonna happen. The person's not here. That's where my healing came. And so I am able to say, Mom, I miss you. When I came into sobriety, and they're like, just think of a positive thought you have of your mom, because they were trying to help me work through that. I don't have any positives. I have no good. Changed my whole way of thinking. There is good if I look for it. There's always good. And so I like to think that way when it comes to people in general. I always try to look for the good in people. And unfortunately, in my every time I'm going to hit a birthday, something transitions in my life, and I have something else to learn. And I cannot give sunshine to people. I cannot tell you surrender and you're going to feel so good. I can't tell you that. You have to learn it on your own, because what the program told me is I didn't get here a day sooner than I was supposed to, remember? I wasn't ready to look at myself as an alcoholic until the day I got here. And so I have to respect that, and that helps me understand other people who can't. It's not their time, and it's something that they need to do on their own because I can't give it to them. And so I love that I get to go through life like that, understanding that, because it helps me have compassion for the sick person. You know, because it's a struggle. And people who are not alcoholics or Al-Anon don't understand the disease, and they think we're having a party. You know, we're having a good time without realizing it's become a maintenance plan. A maintenance plan. Everything that was important to us, for the most part for me, went on the back burner. And at the end of my drinking, even my kids were off the burner. Like, I didn't care. My drinking was the most important thing. And today it's not. My sobriety is the most important thing. And I had a friend early in sobriety who said, Anna, you do too much AA. And I was like, so I go back to my elders. Is there such thing as too much AA? Because I was there 3-4 meetings a day. For the 13 months of my first sobriety, I believe my sobriety was my full-time job. I wasn't working. I was being useful, and I was working on my sobriety. That was my full-time job. And I believed it to the core. I'm not ready yet. It's not my time. So that one friend who, you're doing too much AA. He was the one who, he didn't stay. And so that's why I started learning. Not everybody is looking out for you. I had to learn how to be my own best friend in this program. And again, that was just a few years ago. So nothing happens immediately. There's no pill you could take that'll get you there like this. And you want to hear the good part? You don't want the shortcut. Because when you learn to go through something, you come out with a little more dignity and self-respect when you go through it, because you realize on the other side it wasn't as scary as you made it to be, because we could do that. And going around or under or over, you know, I am grateful. And it was a friend of mine who said, do you thank God for your bad days? Why would I do that? And then I learned, I'm grateful, because if it wasn't for my bad days, how would I know how good good is? How would I know how good good was if I don't know how bad my bad was? If it was all sweet, there would be nothing to grow through. You know what I'm saying? So as long as I take that attitude of gratitude and that there's always something for me to learn, whether I like it or not, I could sit in my own shit because it's familiar, it's cozy, and it's warm, no matter how stinky it could be. But today, I don't like to do that. Today, I know what good feels like. I don't want to sit in that. So sometimes I get antsy and I want God to show me quickly. What am I supposed to learn? Can we put some wheels on this? You know, or I have to call my sponsor. I learned in God's timing, God's will and my will. I learned the difference because God's will is so smooth and sweet and perfect. And my will is always anxiety, panic, anxiousness, sleepless night, and way too many to-do lists. You know? So, middle? Okay. So anywho, I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got to get a passport. I got to do some traveling. I never thought I would leave California. One of my first trips was to London and Paris. Spent Christmas and New Year's out there. I learned in this program how to be my best friend. And what I learned in this program not too long ago was the importance of loving myself and validating myself. I didn't realize that you guys really meant the truth. We'll love you till you learn to love yourself. And I love myself. Do my nails, do my hair. No, it's deeper than that. When I stop talking to myself like a piece of shit, then I start learning to love myself. Because positive self-talk, whew, negative self-talk is self-defeating and it's not loving. I am not loving myself like you hear. Would you treat a friend like that? I am important. I matter. You matter. How you talk to yourself is what you're going to end up believing. So I like to end this with the whole concept behind believe. Believe that there's a power out there greater than you. Believe that you are worthy of this program. Believe that you are lovable. Start loving yourself. Validate yourself. You don't need to rely on anybody else's validation. They'll have their own opinion. Know that you're worthy and you've earned a seat to be here. And there are people that you don't need to know. When you go to a new area, they're going to know you. And then you're going to know them. And you're going to start developing connections everywhere because this is a huge family. Huge family. The GSR has taught me that we just translated the big book into 72 languages. In my area 93, we have 28 districts, 8 of which is all Spanish speaking. I didn't see Latinos until I went to my first area assembly, and I'm like, where did all these Mexicans come from? You know, I thought they were all buying beer. I was so stoked. You know, where'd they all come? I went to my friend instantly. Robert, where did all these Mexicans come from? He's like, Anna, we're a big part of Area 93. We go down to Ventura, Oxnard. We're like all spread out. I felt so good because I want everybody to have this. Doesn't matter what color you are, where you come from. If you were born with a silver spoon up your ass or a plastic spoon, it doesn't matter. When you get here, it could be pinchy chopsticks. It doesn't matter. You know, like I said, we all earned our seats, so I would hope that your takeaway would believe that. Have hope, have belief, and trust in the process, and let go. Don't be dragged. You don't need to be dragged. So with that, thank you, Anthony, for asking me to do this. Thanks.